I was out for a week, and then we had a young man come and teach class interested in our associate position here. So it's been, this is the third week. Glad to get back into it. And we will, Lord willing, have this session this morning in Daniel, and then we'll come back next week and do a wrap up. So if you've got any questions, any alibis, anything you want to come back and look at, if we don't get that done today, Lord willing, you can do it next Sunday. That is our plan anyway. But today is an interesting class. Stafford put three chapters in this session, chapter 10, 11, and 12, and there are reasons for that. Previous prophecies that Daniel had been given were also with interpretation. The prophecies in chapter 11 that are lengthy and very detailed have no interpretation. But what Stafford has done is looked back in history and found historic details that match up perfectly, like a hand in a glove, with the things that God had delivered to Daniel in chapter 11. But before we get to chapter 11, yes, anybody need a worksheet or a review quiz? We'll get started with the review quiz in a minute. This is just kind of the introductory, getting back into it for what we've been out for a couple of weeks. And chapter 10 is interesting because it looks very much with what happened to Daniel there, the same kind of thing happened with John in the beginning of the Revelation. I'm sure you'll see the similarity. So, if everybody's got a worksheet and a review quiz, let's get started with the review quiz. Number one, Daniel's been reading from the book of Jeremiah, where he learns that the Babylonian captivity is to last how many years? 70 years. 70-year captivity. And that's, if you want to reference that, chapter 25 and 29 of Jeremiah. We'll point that out. Since he and the first captives have now been in Babylon for, and you got to do the math, how long has he been in captivity? About 68 years. Let's say 68, because there are a lot of time references in Daniel. I'm sure you've noticed in the first year of this king, in the third year of that king, in chapters 2, 7, 9, 11, 12, several chapters begin this way in the first or third or second or 97th year of whichever king. And so he's giving us time references. But by this time, it's been 68 years. So in two more years, right around that time frame, they'll be coming back. Number two, Daniel prays to God, stating that God is blank. Great. God is great. And the Jews are sinners. And they are sinners just like whom? Just like the rest of us. But the sinners are the ones in this case, or the Jews are the ones in this case who are pointed out as sinners because they're the ones who've been sent into captivity. So this is about them and their story at this point. And Daniel is, he's not catching up, but he's kind of catching us up on history when he says he's been researching in Jeremiah. And it says 7 years. It's almost been 70 years. And Daniel is praying to God saying, we got ourselves into this mess, and you are just, you are great, you did the right thing, and now you're going to return us by your great and mighty hand. That's the kind of prayer that Daniel's praying. So Daniel prays to God, stating that God's great and the Jews are sinners. Number three, Daniel reasons with God that it will show his blank to return the Jews. Anybody got a fill in for that blank? Mercy is an excellent answer. And you read through the text and you can get this. This is what he's saying. It will also show his power, his greatness. Several aspects of God would be borne out in him returning the Jews to their land. And that it will also be good for God's, what would you put in that blank? I would put name. Be good for his name. The name of God will be praised, glorified, vindicated, all of those things, when God fulfills exactly what he said he would fulfill. Daniel is told, this is number four, that from the blank to rebuild until the next destruction of Jerusalem, what would you put in that first blank there in number four? From the decree to rebuild. From the decree to rebuild until the next destruction of Jerusalem may be represented by 77s. 70 weeks is correct, because what's a week? It's a seven. Different ways of saying the same thing. So Jerusalem may be represented by 77s, or the next destruction of Jerusalem be represented by 77s. During this time, the blank blank will come and be cut off. And this might have been a little confusing, but it's in the text. The Prince Messiah, or Messiah Prince, will be cut off. Both those terms are used. Prince Messiah, Messiah Prince, will be cut off. Number five, two beginning dates proposed as the starting point for the prophecy are, and this would have been a hard one to get unless you're just looking right off your worksheet from 3 or 4 weeks ago. What would the first date be? First date would be 536, which corresponds to the first deportation, which was 606 B.C. Then you add 70 years to that, and it's kind of weird because it's B.C., so you add 70 years, and it doesn't make it 676. It makes it 536. So 536 B.C., and the next date that you would put in there is 457 B.C. The first date's from Ezra 6, where Ezra talks about the decree made by Cyrus. And if that's the decree in question, then there you have it noted in Scripture. But also in Ezra chapter 7, you have Artaxerxes making a decree, and that's in 457. When you look at the historical dates, you'll see that. So we've got these two kings. But the point is, God says, I'm sending you back to rebuild your city, to rebuild the temple, after you've been in captivity for 70 years, and Jerusalem is desolated, decimated, nothing there. And God says, I'm bringing you back, and I'm going to do it through some heathen pagan kings, and they're going to foot the bill for this. And that's exactly what happens. So we can look at these dates, and we might get a little confused, but the bottom line is God fulfills what he says he's going to do, sends his people back. Why does he send them back? Why did the Jews exist in the first place? One reason, his name is Jesus. That's it. Never lose sight of this one fact. The existence of the Jewish people are because God wants to bless the whole world. That's why he called Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. Abraham, I'm going to have you get up out of where you belong. I'm going to send you into a place you've never been before, but I'm going to make of you a great nation. Abraham says, I don't have any children, and I'm 75 years old. God says, that's all right. I'm going to give you one. I'm going to wait 25 years. You'll be 100. Your wife will be 90, but you'll have a son, and from that son will come the nation through whom I'm going to bring my son into the world to bless the world with salvation. By the way, going to be some hiccups along the way, a few bumps. This nation's going to rise up and rebel time and time and time again. I'm going to have to bring them back to repentance. They're eventually, most of them are going to go off into captivity in Assyria. We'll never see them again. But the ones that are left in Judea, they'll go off into captivity too, but I'll bring them back after 70 years. I'm going to reestablish them as a people. And if people follow the history of these people, they're going to see why I named them what I named them, which is Israel. What does the name Israel mean? He who struggles with God. And in watching my struggle with this nation, you will see what it's like for you as an individual to have the same struggle with me, which is what you and I do all the time. We wrestle with God. Lord, you still going to save me after what I did, after what I said, after the way I think? Yeah, I'm going to save you because you keep your faith in me. Yeah, but Lord, my flesh, I know. That's why I sent my son in the flesh. So he in the flesh could overcome sin and be sacrificed to pay the debt for your sin. And that's why we're reading Daniel. What? This is just part of the story. Where's Daniel? He's in captivity. He's not even in Israel. He's not even in Jerusalem. No temple. He's in Babylonian captivity, and God says, I'm going to show you how great I am. I'm going to put my people in captivity in a foreign nation. And while they're there, I'm going to, you guys just chill. Now, that's not exactly what Jeremiah said. But what did he tell them to do while they were in captivity? Build homes, get married, plant a garden, live your life, just wait for 70 years and I'll bring you back. Now, we know what happened to a lot of those folks. They died while they were in captivity, not because of the captivity, but just as a matter of course. But thousands of them came back. You can read those stories in Nehemiah and Ezra. They came back. Even those who stayed did great work. Daniel stayed. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego stayed. Who else stayed? There was Esther. What did Esther do? But she saved her people while being queen of Persia. Her uncle Mordecai is the one who mentored her and helped her see the wisdom of God in his providence. It's the whole story. When you look at it, it's like, wow. It's absolutely astounding. And all it is God just doing his thing. Because that's the way he works. And he's not worried about anything like we worry about stuff. Some little something happens in our life. And, oh, no, how am I going to do this now? Oh, that's not going to work. Oh, worry, worry, worry. What does God say over and over and over in the Bible? Don't worry. Don't be anxious. Don't be afraid. I'm going to work it out. And he's doing that all the time. And that's why we're studying Daniel. So please don't ever get the idea this is just a little piece of Bible history. No, this is a piece of the puzzle that shows us the grandness of God and his plan. And I'm doing a lot of talking I wasn't planning on doing. We got stuff to do in this class here. So let's go to chapter 10, and we need a reader for the first 9 verses of Daniel chapter 10. Who would like to do that? Daniel chapter 10, 1 through 9. Anybody? Anybody still awake? All right, Bob, go ahead.
A message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, and the message was true and one of great conflict, but he understood the message and had an understanding of the vision. In those days, I, Daniel, had been mourning for 3 entire weeks. I did not eat tasty food, nor did meat or wine enter my mouth, nor did I use any ointment at all until the entire 3 weeks were completed. On the 24th day of the first month, while I was on the bank of the great river, that is the Tigris, I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, there was a certain man dressed in linen, whose waist was girded with a belt of pure gold, Uphaz. His body was like beryl, his face had the appearance of lightning, his eyes were like flaming torches, his arms and feet like the gleam of polished bronze, and the sound of his words like the sound of a tumult. Now I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, while the men who were with me did not see the vision. Nevertheless, a great dread fell on them, and they ran away to hide themselves. So I was left alone and saw this great vision, yet no strength was left in me, for my natural color turned to a deathly pallor, and I retained no strength. But I heard the sound of his words, and as soon as I heard the sound of his words, I fell into a deep sleep on my face, with my face to the ground.
All right, try to get a handle on what is happening with Daniel, in whose presence he is, this person. It says in verse 5, I lifted my eyes, looked, behold, there was a certain man. A certain man. Now, Gabriel's been part of the account. It doesn't appear to be Gabriel. Later on, he's going to record that this man says his only ally is Michael, so it's not Michael. A certain man is who we're looking at here, dressed in linen, whose waist was girded with a belt of pure gold of Uphaz. His body also was like beryl, and that's a gemstone of great glory, beauty. His face had the appearance of lightning. His eyes were like flaming torches. His arms and feet like the gleam of polished bronze. And the sound of his words were like what? Sound of a tumult or a multitude, depending on your translations. Now, hold on to that and go to Revelation chapter 1. Look at verse 12. I turned to see, John says, I turned to see the voice that was speaking with me, and having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the middle of the lampstands, I saw one like a son of man, clothed in a robe reaching to the feet and girded across his chest with a golden sash. His head and his hair were like white like white wool, like snow, and his eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet, verse 15, were like burnished bronze, and it's been made to glow in a furnace, and his voice was like the sound of many waters. Who is this that John is seeing in Revelation 1? This is Jesus. It's a description of Jesus, and he leaves no doubt as he goes on in the text. But this is nearly identical to the one Daniel is seeing in chapter 10. Is it Jesus? I personally believe that it is. I have no way to prove this, but we're pretty sure it's not Gabriel, it's not Michael, and it's one before whom Daniel, he will say later in chapter 10 that he became like a dead man, which is exactly what John says here. Verse 17, Revelation 1:17, when I saw him, I fell at his feet like a dead man. So the same general description of the individual, the same general response by the one seeing the individual. Do you remember Paul on the road to Damascus? What happens? A great light shines around him. This is Acts chapter 9. And what happens to Paul or Saul at that time? Falls to the ground and he becomes blind. And he hears the voice of the one speaking to him. And he says, "Who are you, Lord?" The Greek word's kurios. It doesn't mean that he now knows this is Jesus, but he means that this word is a word that you would use to address somebody that you know has power over you, authority over you. And so he says, "Who are you, Lord?" We use it to refer to Jesus, but we don't know that that's what Saul was doing, but he was using it to address somebody that he knew was now in authority over him. And the interesting thing is, Daniel says those who were with him heard and were in dread, but didn't understand what Daniel was hearing. And Paul says the same thing in Acts chapter 9. Jesus speaks to Paul or Saul, and he understands what Jesus is saying, but the men hear a sound, but they don't know what's going on, yet they are scared to death as well. So the similarities lead me to believe that Daniel is being spoken to by Jesus in Daniel chapter 10. We shouldn't be surprised at this. It's not like, "Oh, wow, Marty's going off the deep end." What's the first book of the Bible say? What's the first verse of the Bible say? In the beginning, God did what? He created the heavens and the earth. And then you read verse after verse after verse where God said, and when God said something, what happened? Whatever he said happened. When do we find out that's Jesus? Not until John chapter 1. John the apostle reveals, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And not anything was created that he didn't create," is what John says. So, hey, that was Jesus all the time. We just didn't know it until John revealed it to us. It looks like Jesus in Daniel chapter 10. You come up with your own opinion, whoever it is. But I have no problem seeing Jesus involved in the history of God's people, because they're the ones through whom he's going to come into the world. Yes, so no doubt there that that's who Paul met or Saul met on the road to Damascus. All right, do you have this worksheet? Let's go through some of this. I want you to see the research that's been done and how it matches what is said to Daniel, what Daniel is told in chapter 11. Now, we've read the history of how there was Babylon, and what nation came after Babylon? The Medes and the Persians. Who came after the Medes and the Persians? The Greeks. What happened to the Greek Empire that Alexander had brought into existence? When he died, it was divided between four of his generals. And who came after the Greeks? The Romans. So that's the history as we have it from Daniel and from the reality of history. And that's what we have in verse 4. His empire will be broken up and parceled out towards the four winds. It will not go to his descendants. So we're down to that part. So verse 5. King of the south shall be strong. One of his princes shall be strong above him. So Ptolemy received Egypt to the south of Israel. So he is called the king of the south. One of his generals, Seleucus, ruled more territory than Ptolemy. Since Seleucus reigned in Syria, he was the king of the north. He and his successors are called by that name in the prophecy. So that's what we know from history. What's on the right is secular history, but it matches up perfectly with what God has told Daniel in chapter 11, verse 5. Then verse 6. These two rulers shall be joined through the marriage of the daughter of the king of the south with the king of the north. All right, that's an interesting prophecy. And remember, Daniel's receiving this prophecy, but unlike the others, he's not getting an interpretation with it. No interpretation, just the telling of what's going to happen. So look across the page on the right column. Ptolemy the second became king in 285 BC. In 281 BC, 4 years later, Seleucus was murdered and succeeded by his son Antiochus the first. Antiochus the second became king in 261 BC. Hostilities between the kings of the north and south had been going on for several years, but were ended when Bernice, daughter of Ptolemy the second, married Antiochus the second. Antiochus had already separated from his wife, Laodice, or Laodice, or whatever you want to call her. I haven't met her, so I don't know how she pronounces her name, but there it is. So he's separated from his wife, and he's married Bernice, and that is exactly what God had told Daniel in verse 6 of chapter 11. These two rulers will be joined through marriage, the daughter of the king of the south with the king of the north. So drop down to the next part of verse 6. Left-hand column, she shall not retain her power, and his power shall not last. So she won't keep her power, and his power won't last. And then we read in the right-hand column, after her father died in 250 B.C., Antiochus II divorced Bernice. Now, why did he marry Bernice? That was a marriage to make peace. Well, now her dad's dead. Well, I'm getting rid of you. And what's he do? He says, hey, you know, I sort of miss Laodice or whatever her name is, so I'm going to get her back. And what does she do? She poisons him. I get you back, you no good. You just see the humanity in this history. And God is saying, yeah, I'm telling Daniel all this stuff, and you'll have to figure it out when you see what actually happens and how it matches up exactly with what I told Daniel would happen. So Laodice, who then poisoned Antiochus and encouraged her son Seleucus II to murder both Bernice and her child. Now, why would she want Bernice dead and her child? Succession, the authority of succession. Get rid of her. She might be the queen if we don't kill her. Get rid of that boy or child. I think it's a boy. But if she's gone and he's still there, they'll say, well, he's the rightful heir, so let's get rid of both of them. The whole plan for the political marriage fails, which is exactly what verse 6 had said. She shall not return her power, and his power shall not last, because she's going to poison that guy. So verse 7, one from her family line will successfully attack the king of the north. Over to the right column, the brother of Bernice, Ptolemy III, That sounds like I'm telling you somebody told me, but that's his name. Ptolemy III becomes king of the south. He successfully attacks Seleucus II. By the way, there'll be a test on this at the end of class. You got to read this to see, wow, it's all just like God said. Surprise, surprise. Left-hand column again, verse 9. King of the north will attack the king of the south, but will return to his own land. And then right-hand column, Seleucus II in 240 BC regained much of his territory, but was defeated when he attacked the king of the south. Verse 10, left-hand column, sons of king of the north shall attack the king of the south. Right-hand column, three sons of Seleucus II attacked Palestine in 221 and 219, a territory of the king of the south. By 217, they had taken all of Palestine, but Ptolemy IV defeated them at the Battle of Raphia. You see how it's all matching up? This is why when some read Daniel 11, they said, oh, this was not written early when you say it was. This was written after the fact. This is way too accurate to have been written before all these things happened. This had to be written after the fact. Unless you believe that God is God and able to say what's going to happen before it happens, which is what he's been doing all along, those statements, those kinds of arguments are the arguments from the standpoint of a lack of faith in God. That's really all they are. There's no evidential basis for them. All the evidence points to these things being written down long before they happen. All right, so we're on the second page, left-hand column, verse 16 and 17. King of the north now occupies all of the glorious land, which is what it's called in the text, and comes with equitable conditions. He shall give his daughter in a political marriage, but this will not bring success. So we read in the right-hand column, Antiochus III occupies all of Palestine, the glorious land. He deals equitably with them, sending money for the temple service and releasing the Jews from some taxes. Amen. He betroths his daughter Cleopatra. You ever heard of Cleopatra? To the seven-year-old Ptolemy V. What did you get on your seventh birthday? The marriage is consummated 5 years later. He would have been 12, but Cleopatra sides with her husband and not her father, so the ploy fails. And by the way, this is not the famous Cleopatra. This is another Cleopatra. Verse 18. He shall turn his face to the isles, shall take many, but a prince shall bring him down. And then right-hand column, after Hannibal was defeated by the Romans. Remember Hannibal? What did Hannibal do? What's he famous for? He took elephants and attempted to cross the Alps and attack the Romans. That's his famous place in history. But he was defeated in 202 BC, and he came to Antiochus III and encouraged him to move toward Greece and the islands. The islands, that's what is mentioned in Daniel's prophecy. He made efforts to do this, but was soundly defeated by the Romans, a prince, at Thermopylae in 191 BC and at Magnesium in 190. He probably would have won that battle, but unfortunately, unknowingly, he drank the milk of Magnesium and it did him in. So, now that's not actual history. I just thought I'd throw that in there. The Romans taxed him heavily and took his son Antiochus IV Epiphanes to ensure payment. Do you remember Antiochus IV Epiphanes? Oh, he's going to get his later. He's the one who was the one who caused the now I can't even think of the term. Oh, well, we'll come to it. Some of you probably remember it. Anybody think of it right now? Abomination of Desolation, that's what it was. That was Antiochus IV Epiphanes. So verse 19, he shall turn his face toward the fortresses of his own land, but shall fail. That's verse 19. Then in the right-hand column, Antiochus III marched against the revolting Armenians and robbed their temples, but was slain by the Elamites. So he died in disgrace. So he does turn his face towards the fortresses of his own land, but he fails. This is fascinating. Verse 20, his successor will send out a tax collector who shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. That's a pretty specific prophecy. So, right-hand column, Seleucus IV comes to the throne. He sends a tax collector named Heliodonus. Should be Heliodonate if he's taking taxes, I guess. But it's Heliodonus. And he sends him to take money from the temple in Jerusalem. Soon after, Seleucus IV is removed from the throne, perhaps by poison. All right, there you have it. Verse 21. He'll be succeeded by a contemptible person who obtains the kingdom by flatteries, and he will invade the kingdom and by intrigue shall win. An overwhelming army shall be swept away before him. Both it and the prince of the covenant shall be destroyed. And then you get in the right-hand column. It says he wins over Ptolemy the VI in 170 and deposes Onias the II, prince of the covenant, the high priest, so he can put in another who will pay him more and do more to force the Jews toward Grecian culture. Verse 25, top of the next sheet. He shall fight with the king of the south, who will have a great army but shall lose. Right-hand column, Ptolemy the VI fights with Antiochus the IV but loses. So Antiochus the IV is the winner in that battle. Verse 27, the kings of the south and the north meet at one table, but it shall not prosper. Right-hand column, Antiochus the IV and Ptolemy Philometor called a truce and met at a conference table. They lied to each other. Imagine that. And formed an alliance, but they failed to throw out the claimant to the throne, Ptolemy Sicon. Or Fiscon. That's probably why they failed to throw him out. They couldn't pronounce his name right, so we'll just leave him there. We can't even say his name. You got to have fun with this stuff somehow. This is just wow. Next line down on the left-hand side, still part of verse 27, the king of the north then returns to his own country, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant. Right-hand column, Antiochus the IV. Remember, this is Antiochus Epiphanes. He returns with spoils of war through Palestine on his way to Syria. He plunders even through the land of the Jews. Verse 29, he will again attack the south, but without as much success. Right-hand column, in 168, Antiochus attacked Egypt again, 168 AD, but is not victorious. Same, verse 29, ships of the western coastland will come against him, and he will have indignation against them. Right-hand column, Egypt asks for help from Rome, which sends ships and soldiers. They come and defeat Antiochus. As he returns to Syria, he passes in anger through Israel. Verse 31, he shall profane the temple and take away the continual burnt offering. He shall also set up an abomination that makes desolate. And right-hand column, he seeks to get the Jews to be more like Greeks. He offers swine on the altar and made observing the drunken orgy to Bacchus compulsory. Bacchus was one of the gods that was worshipped, quote unquote, by the Greeks and also by the Romans. And he was the god of revelry and drunkenness and wine. And he's still famous today in the philosophy of many. But nobody goes to church for Bacchus. It's just that that's what they want to do. They want to live like that. So, still in the right-hand column, finishing that block, he prevents from their practices of the Sabbath and feast. So he went down to Egypt, and he fought, and he lost, and he's upset. So he's coming back home through Israel, and what do you do when you're angry and upset? You lash out at people. And so that's what he does to the Jews in Palestine at the temple. He desecrates the temple. He says, you people need to be more like Greeks. I'm going to wipe out this stupid idea you have of not having pork in your temple. We're going to desecrate a the temple by offering swine up here and going to try to make you guys more like Greek. You'll come over to my way thinking, well, right, yeah, he doesn't know the Jews at all. But that's what he does. And so there's a lot of turmoil. There is the abomination of desolation. Daniel speaks of it. Remember when Jesus was talking about the destruction of Jerusalem? He will refer to the abomination of desolation mentioned by Daniel the prophet. That's in Luke, Matthew 24, but also in Luke 19. I think it's Luke 19 where Jesus mentions the mention of the abomination of desolation by Daniel, and Antiochus Epiphanes is at the center of all of that. Verse 34. Wait a minute. Verse 32. Don't want to skip that. Some will go against the covenant, but others will be faithful and strong. And then in the right-hand column, some accept his ways, but many others refuse to participate in his idolatry. And left-hand column again, verse 34, some resist Antiochus. They will be purified by trial, even to the time of the end, because the time is appointed. And then in the right-hand column, Judas Maccabeus, a Jew, leads a resistance against Antiochus IV starting in 166 B.C., but not with complete success. They eventually succeed in driving him out when he has problems elsewhere to which he must attend. Have you heard of the Maccabean Revolt? If you haven't, look it up. Do a little research on the Maccabean Revolt and how they fought against Antiochus IV, Epiphanes. And a lot of this would never have happened if he hadn't been so mean. I'm not a big fan of Taylor Swift, but she does have that song, "Why You Gotta Be So Mean?" You ever heard that song? That's a good song because of the idea. And a lot of this stuff is happening because people are just evil. They're just mean. If they just mind their own business and do unto others as they would have them do, none of this would happen. So much of the trouble in the world is just because of evil people and nobody's standing up to stop them. So we need people willing to stand up and stop evil. Maybe that's going to be you in some circumstance and situation. And if it is you, if you find yourself there, don't be afraid to stand up. Maybe God's got you there for that very specific purpose, to stand up and stop evil where you see it. All right. Under all of that stuff is a paragraph where Stafford says this: starting in Daniel 11:36 through the end of chapter 12, the interpretation can be less certainly given. Some consider these additional verses as still being about Antiochus IV, while others think they refer to the rising of the Roman Empire. It's beyond the scope of this study to delve into these last few verses of Daniel's last prophecy. In other words, not sure what this means. And instead of making something up, just going to tell you, we don't know what that means. Never be afraid to say, "I don't know." That's a much better answer than trying to buffalo somebody into thinking you're smarter than you actually are. That never works. Don't ask me how I know. So, all right, there is an account of 10 through 12. I know there's a lot of detail left out. So Lord willing, next week we'll come back. We'll look at an overview of Daniel and its place in history and how it all works together. And if you've got any questions that I can't answer, Harold will be here. So, and who else am I? Billy's going to be here. We'll just point to some of these guys and say they'll be here. They'll answer them for you. So you guys do some studying between now and next week, so you can answer any question, because I've done enough talking. Anybody got anything? Right. I think you're talking about, chapter 10, Daniel chapter 10, verse 10, which we read down to 9, but we didn't go any farther. But you're talking about what is said a little further after that. So this is Daniel 10, verse 10. It says, "Then behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. He said to me, O Daniel, man of high esteem, understand the words that I am about to tell you and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. Then he said to me, Do not be afraid, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart on understanding this and on humbling yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to your words. So he's a man of high esteem, and this one, whom I believe to be Jesus, has come in response to Daniel's words and his commitment to God and to what is right. And I believe Jesus does the same thing for each one of us. He condescends to us, and condescend, we normally use that in a bad context, but it's in the most excellent context. He condescends to us when we open ourselves up to him. What did Jesus say in Revelation chapter 3? Behold, I stand where? At the door. Let's read it. Revelation 3. By the way, he says this after writing a letter, having John dictate a letter, that is, to the church at Laodicea, and he calls them lukewarm, and he says, I'm going to spit you out of my mouth if you don't straighten up. So that's a hard message. But then he says this in verse 20, after giving that hard message about spitting them out if they don't straighten up, he says, Behold, I stand at the door and knock. When somebody knocks at your door, what are they hoping will happen? You will come to the door and you will open the door. And Jesus says, I will come into him and will dine with him. Can you imagine? The creator of the universe, the one who spoke all of this into existence and who rules in the spiritual realm way beyond this physical universe, he says to you and he says to me, I'm knocking at your door. If you'll open your door to me, what would it take for him to knock your door down, grab you by the throat and say, you're going to follow me, you little jerk? Now, he's too holy and right to say that, but I'm saying that because me. But he doesn't do that. He says, I'm standing at the door and I'm knocking. If you'll open, I'm going to come in and we're going to sit down and have a meal together. That's the God of the universe. That's been the God of the universe since the Garden of Eden. He's always been this way. This is always what he has wanted. And he's inviting us to invite him because we don't have a clue how blessed we would be if we would simply allow him into our lives. That's the God that we worship. And people have this idea about God. He's a big white-haired guy with a stick who's going to smack you if you make a false move. That's what the devil wants us to think about God. If you read the book, you find out this is God. Who else would say, the only way to save you is to let my son die? And Jesus, his son, goes, I'm for that plan, God. Send me down there. By the way, I don't want to go down and just die real quick. Send me down there to live among them for 30-some years. And let me bring some of those guys around me and live with them day and night for 3 years. Let me teach them and show them and put up with all their foolishness. And then let me go to Jerusalem and be contradicted every day and every place I go by those who think they're the smart ones in the word that you've given them. Let them demean me and abuse me and treat me like that all of the time I'm trying to minister them in truth. And then I know I'm going to be crucified. And I'm not looking forward to that. We see that in the garden. But he says, I want your will to be done, and your will is for them to be saved by my sacrifice. And then the Hebrew writer comes along in Hebrews chapter 12, and he says of Jesus, for the joy set before him, what did he do? He endured the cross, despising the shame. Now tell me, what could possibly be the joy set before Jesus that would compel him to endure the cross and despise the shame? In every one of our stories, what do we like to see happen at the end? Not only does the good guy win, but the good guy wins by doing what with the people who are being oppressed? He saves them. That's our favorite stories. It's not just that the good guy wins, but he wins by doing the thing that delivers those being oppressed from the evil that's there. Name a story. One bell or two? One. I'm not necessarily recommending these, but how many of you remember the Dirty Harry movies? Oh, yeah. I love those personally because nothing held him back from delivering justice to those who deserved it. Finally, somebody's going to pull out a .44 Magnum and do some justice on the streets. Now, I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying we all have a hunger and a thirst for justice to be done. And that's also what God is all about. By the way, that's what the death of Jesus is about. Because if he had forgiven you and me without paying our debt, that would not be just. And so he showed himself to be just by paying my debt and your debt. Wow, that's some big stuff. All right, well, that's it. We got to stop. There's been a bell. The authoritative bell has rung. Lord love you.